We're here to discuss the ups, downs, and sideways of the sport of figure skating, and maybe give you +5 GOE along the way. This week, we have Kat and Bex here to do a mid-season check-in and discuss the continuing challenge of holding figure skating competitions during COVID-19. So we will be focusing primarily on the challenges organizationally and the actions taken by the ICU and feds and the ramifications of it throughout how they've chosen to hold competitions and what the rest of the season looks like. But we do want to start off a little by just talking about some of the implications on the sort of fan and viewer side in terms of the audience of how this season has gone.
Right. Especially since, well, Bex, I don't know about you, but I have really not watched a lot of figure skating at all this season.
I think this is the least figure skating I've watched in like a decade or more. Granted, there hasn't been as much, but...
But even considering that I did not watch a single program until Cup of China.
Yes, right.
That's like a solid 8 months that I didn't watch figure skating.
Let's be clear, like, Kat and I do not represent, you know, all figure skating fans by a long stretch. But we and a lot of people I know and talk to are, you know, the sort of people who go to as many competitions in person during normal seasons as they can. You know, I watch, like, I think last Grand Prix season, bar, like, you know, maybe the odd pairs program that was airing at 3 a.m. or something. I think I probably watched, like, pretty much every single event of every single competition, like.
Right. In general, it's just, I think for me personally, it's been really hard to reconcile kind of seeing how the ISU and how the Federation has been kind of shirking a lot of the responsibilities of holding these events safely with the athletes' best interests in mind. And I feel that impacting my own personal investment in the sport, because ultimately, if I can't trust them to take care of the athletes, then why should I care? I'm ultimately watching skating for the athletes and for them to stay safe and healthy. And if I don't believe that that's the case, then I don't feel any interest in supporting the sport.
Right. And it's just kind of a alarming, depressing state of affairs, because on the one hand, you want to continue to support athletes, but it has been really tricky this season, because there have been so many steps taken by federations and by the ISU that just are deeply concerning in terms of their priorities, because they do have broadcasting obligations and they have, you know, they feel that they have to carry on, and it is very complex in terms of all the nuances and factors. But there are some concerns about the fact that through their choices, they are alienating a considerable number of fans who... Figure skating is a sport that, while their priority should be their athletes and their future and their development, there is this pretty strong connection with fans and an audience as more of a performance sport. And also, it's a sport that has struggled a lot with its popularity in recent years, save for perhaps in Russia and in Japan, or occasionally China a bit, in Korea. But in general.
Yeah, especially the waning interest in the U.S. has been a big impact on the sport as a whole.
Right.
And of course, none of this is easy. I just want to preface this entire episode by saying this is not an easy thing by any means to discuss. Obviously, there are some huge long-term ramifications on the athletes to, you know, canceling the entire season. It affects their livelihoods. But I think that a lot of the carelessness and callousness of the federations and the ISU kind of make a lot of what's happening so unacceptable from an optics point of view.
Anyway, we just wanted to preface and be very frank that it's a mid-season check-in, but we're not going to be gushing over new programs.
Yeah, sorry.
Or, you know, yelling about like edges and, you know, people not doing the patterns well or something, because frankly, like, the only event I've watched in full was NHK ladies, and we did follow, to be frank, we did follow how all these events were run and check in on them very, very closely, right, because we were so concerned about them.
It's hard to wake up at like 7 o'clock in the morning for a competition that you don't think should even be happening. So
it really is. Like, I, you know, I would pop, I think at the beginning of the season, I popped into some Russian streams and got so uncomfortable at how the competitions were being handled that I just could not suppress the anger or frustration to continue watching. So just wanted to get that out of the way and be frank about that, and also just raise the topic and the ramifications of, also from an audience perspective, the difficulties or some of the challenges of even following a very beloved sport during this period.
I guess our overview of the Grand Prix series, again, is going to be a little different. We're just going to be talking a little bit about like the way that different competitions were run. So off the bat, I think that we wanted to compare kind of the way that Restelecom, NHK, and Cup of China were held, because very different choices were made for those competitions. I think, I don't know about you, but seeing how many people in the audience at Restelecom made me super uncomfortable.
From what I can tell from every Russian competition in general that I looked at, social distancing in terms of seating or anything was never ever enforced, right, in any fashion whatsoever. So that was definitely a very concerning trend, both in Restelecom and in Russia's other domestic competitions, especially given Russia is probably, after the US, one of the absolute most concerning countries in terms of their status. And at least Skate America, although I had a lot of concerns about their so-called bubble, did indeed have no audience. There was some slight issues in terms of skaters maybe socializing a little more off camera in the audience than perhaps would have been advisable given their projected attempts at a bubble. But that said, we haven't heard necessarily a lot of ramifications coming out. And I think one thing also to look at really on the audience side is that China was also a very good example, Cup of China, of having a country with currently some of the lower reported cases. And there's even been other events in China that have been held, you know, with audiences or recordings, but this, they didn't have an audience. They took the absolute safest method. And this was also, you know, in China, most of the national team trains together, they're in a similar location, and still they took probably some of the best precautions to hold a very, very safe event in comparison to countries that are on the opposite end of the spectrum in terms of transfer COVID, such as the US, such as Russia, and even Japan, where it's spiking.
I feel like, yeah, even in within the athletes, a lot of the Chinese athletes like haven't seen their families or traveled to see their families in well over a year. It's all been closed training ever since they got back from Canada. You know, some of the skaters were in Canada prior to returning, and they haven't had any contact with their families in order to maintain everyone's safety and health. And that's a tough sacrifice to make, but it's for the greater good, and it's definitely something that should be commended. Of course, this is a personal responsibility kind of sacrifice that some athletes chose to make and didn't necessarily have to, considering how low the cases are, but ultimately better to err on the side of safety, in my opinion.
And I think one thing you can also compare a bit is that at least at NHK, although there was an audience, they did require masks and attempt to put some efforts at social distancing, but the audience was still, like, this was a 50% capacity stadium. It could have been a 25% capacity stadium and been done much, much more safely, because if you looked at the audience, you know, people were excellent with mask usage, but not everyone was. There were even people who were sitting together, you could see there were, you know, everyone was supposed to be at least a seat apart, but a seat, I've been to Japanese stadiums, it's like 2 feet. Like, it's being generous, it's like 2 feet-ish. Like, it's not a large amount of space. Like, even if they were 2 seats apart, that's still really not ideal, but at least it's better.
Like 3 seats if we were gonna make it true social distancing, if we were gonna follow the whole 6 feet guideline.
From an optics point of view, it was just not ideal. And also just concerns in terms of like getting every, if you have that large of an audience, getting everyone in and out with proper social distancing, let's be honest, it's just not going to happen.
Right, exactly. Like waiting in lines for everything, the bathroom, food, getting in and out of the arena, these are all things that take time and space. So the more people you have, the less space you're going to have between people, especially. And again, and from the optics point of view, Osaka was, there was a report from earlier in the month that said that Osaka was in nearing a red alert due to COVID. And so if you're just a citizen and you're watching the news and you see all of these people gathering still for figure skating competition in an area where COVID cases have been spiking, it does not look great.
It's pretty concerning, especially as Japan has been peaking and really on an upward trend. And with nationals coming up, it's a little concerning. Like, I will say that I'm at least glad they reinforced mask wearing very well and the general sort of internal measures were good, but not ideal.
But let's talk about the big red alert, which is Russia. There's just so much going on with Russian skating. Throughout the season, several skaters have come up positive with COVID. Na on Twitter, her user is at Lift Loop Lunge, created this awesome graphic that lists out all of the Russian athletes that have contracted COVID, been exposed to COVID, been symptomatic, and where they train and who they were exposed to. So you should definitely, we'll link it in the notes, but she did a great job of compiling all of the data, and it's quite a doozy. I gotta tell you, it's very concerning considering how many high profile names there are and just how many people they're exposed to.
Yeah, the spread throughout the training camps and the just general sort of blasé-ness of, well, we've just got to train, and people then start dropping like flies and, you know, kind of rumors of entire camps getting it or getting exposed to it. And all the sheer amount of other people who suddenly have for this season, for some reason, come down with pneumonia, fevers, even though it's not confirmed, is very alarming.
Very, very alarming, especially how young a lot of these athletes are. These are athletes, like, being in top condition is their job. Being in, like, tip-top health, it's what produces their livelihood, essentially. And I think that to be the federation that says we can sacrifice the health of our athletes for the sake of holding competitions is just, I don't know, unimaginably cruel, I think.
The thing is like, all these people are training and getting exposed to, which granted, Russian nationals, we all know, is like the, you know, most terrifying competition of the season, essentially. But they're taking part in this, like, the Russian Cup does not need to happen this year. Like, this convoluted, right? Five stage, like, we've got into like the last stage of it and none of their top athletes can even compete because they're all like keeled over or recovering from the plague. Like, it's just horrifying. Yeah. I'm sorry, but it's horrifying. And some of these people, like, you had people like Evgenia, she returned for training for like a week and caught it, and then was in the hospital for a considerable time, suffered, according to her, devastating lung damage. Like, these are skaters rely so much on their lung capacity.
How many times have you seen a skater look winded after a free skate while they're in top condition?
Yes, the way COVID affects, you know, the lungs.
And even your heart. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. For top athletes, like, what concerns me so much with Russia's adamance about carrying on with these competitions is the fact that we've seen a lot of research and concerning reports about how contracting this disease can essentially turn an elite athlete to a relatively mediocre athlete in terms of just their actual physical capabilities, no matter how hard they push themselves.
Yeah, their stamina and endurance.
Yes. And the fact that this either shows that Russia, you know, they have such a depth of talent that they don't genuinely care about the individual state or success or health of their top talent, because they are confident enough that even in a pre-Olympic season, they have so much talent on the back tap that they can just pull them forwards if there are the few who survived, and in their politicking, that they will be fine. But it's just so alarming.
Yeah, I think that I'm definitely super concerned about how a lot of these athletes are going to survive moving forward, because if you get COVID and you happen to be the unlucky one that gets the severe case, like Zhenya, who was hospitalized and, you know, as we said before, suffered severe lung damage, even if you do miraculously recover enough to get back onto the ice, I think she actually just started getting back on the ice recently, the lack of endurance and stamina will clearly impact your ability to perform and execute at a high level, and also make you more injury prone. And it's not like Zhenya needs more injuries, and especially some of these pair skaters and ice dancers as well. It's dangerous if you're not in your tip-top form, and not just for like the athlete themselves, but they're also their partners. So yeah, if you're a pair skater, you know, the man has to like lift and twirl these girls in the air, like 6 feet off the ground. They kind of rely on their endurance as well to make sure that their partners are safe.
I mean, Russia has the deepest pairs field by far in the world. So if the pairs field, COVID completely rips through them, like, it's just, there's a lot of potential for fallout and severe ramifications down the line.
Yeah, lots of injuries that I'm worried about.
It's, yeah, the injuries, the health conditions, and it's also just so depressing because skaters already are so prone to just the injuries of doing all the terrifying the crazy things that yeah, they do. Like, skaters are always constantly injured. We do not need to add like chronic lung or heart issues to the factor.
And it's also worth noting that Moscow turned one of its ice rinks into a COVID hospital on the day that Rostelecom started in Moscow. So
Russian Fed, despite this, has been seemingly quite at it. Like, they made a concession for their fifth stage of the Russia Cup that they would not have an audience again, and that was their main concession to most of the national team not being able to compete anymore, who had done very well in the previous stages because they're all ill.
It just really makes you wonder about what the ultimate cost of this is going to be. I just can't see. I don't see any reason why these competitions should be held on, especially knowing so many athletes are sick and have gotten sick. Oh, and are we going to talk about how Rostelecom had a banquet?
Okay. Rostelecom was an alarming train wreck. The fact that they went ahead and held a banquet, and you saw skaters' social media updates of them chilling and partying it up, just why this was the most unnecessary measure ever.
And, you know, some of the skaters that were seen at the banquet, they weren't wearing masks, they weren't social distancing, they were taking selfies together.
It looked like a normal banquet, despite it, apart from it all being Russian, which you wouldn't normally see, it looked like right. Your standard banquet. There was no difference that I could tell at all. I mean, I think Russia has claimed that they are doing testing before events, and Russia is not good with transparency, let's be clear.
I'll be real honest, like, not Japan, Russia, or China, they're not known for transparency.
Nope.
So it's been really hard to find guidelines. Like, I actually couldn't find any of the Cup of China guidelines. I'm just going based off of what I know about how the Chinese Federation has been conducting their training and what they did prior to Four Continents when China was at its worst during the pandemic.
This kind of highlights, again, like, the fact that we can't find out anything about the guidelines and stuff. This, again, highlights the sort of frustration with the ISU not stepping up as a governing body in clearly setting the standard mm-hmm. for how these events should be conducted, where they foisted off a lot of the responsibility off on the individual feds. And granted, you know, the situation has varied somewhat country to country, which I'm sure they were allowing for concessions and didn't want to do that. But in general, like, having a consistent standard to follow that is safe and well-designed and has the right priorities is the work that a governing body should be doing. And we pointed that out as a concern in our previous episode looking towards the Grand Prix, but I think seeing the fallout from it has really made it clear that this was a way in which the ISU, in a sense, sort of failed the skating community as a governing body by not taking that responsibility and setting that standard like most sports governing bodies have.
Just the lack of transparency and the lack of foresight, I think, is the main concern for me with the ISU, because looking forward now for the rest of the season, on the day that we're recording this, we just got wind of the news that the European Championships were canceled and that the Grand Prix final, which was scheduled to be in Beijing this weekend, actually, that was postponed originally, also got canceled.
Yay.
I'm sorry, but like, what were they going to do with the Grand Prix final? Like, literally, no one can travel. It's not even like a real competition. Like,
right. We had four bizarre, sort of mostly domestic faux nationals. Everyone competed once. Are they going to hold it in like May? Like, everyone knew there was no way it could come off as a feasible competition. Ridiculous. So, yes, yay. Thanks for canceling it. Good job. Glad you got your act together. So basically the only major, Junior Worlds has been cancelled. Four Continents has obviously been cancelled.
The entire junior season was cancelled, which is pretty, like, devastating for the juniors, but necessary. Now Worlds is the only major competition left for the season. And it's looking like the ISU is still holding to the, we are going to hold out hope that everything will be okay in 3 to 4 months. And I think that this is what has led to this downward spiral this entire half of the year, which is the ISU constantly just pushing back and kind of dilly-dallying on making a definitive decision about what they should be doing for, you know, the Grand Prix series or Challenger series or the Grand Prix final, because they just want to hold out hope that it can happen, and then just keep stringing athletes along and keeping the athletes in limbo. It's just such a cruel game that they're playing, I think.
I think another implication to look at is the fact that if the ISU definitively canceled Worlds now, probably nationals in most countries. Some countries have canceled their nationals. I believe France did, although they're doing another qualifying event or something. So I'm not quite sure what the point with canceling it was at this point. But it would at least incentivize probably a lot of countries to definitively cancel nationals that should potentially not be happening.
Right.
And help set a standard for safety in that regard. But obviously they're still continuing to
do this whole, like, pray that everything will be okay.
Right. So let's logistically look at the kind of considerations of, like, reasonably, what does it look like? What are the concerns? You know, what are the potential ways that they could pull it off, and sort of the contributing factors that might encourage them or discourage them one way or the other? So obviously one of the biggest incentives is just, this is the pre-Olympic season.
Right.
This is normally the Worlds where this is like the most important Worlds of every quad, essentially, because it decides Olympic spots, which is a big reason, probably, apart from just the general broadcasting incentives and the general keep things going, that they still are having such a conflict about whether or not to hold it. On the bright side, Worlds is scheduled in March in Sweden. On the bright side, we do have more optimistic news regarding things such as vaccines than I would have forecasted 3 months ago, 6 months ago. But I think we still need to look at the logistics of how that would play in to holding an event.
Right. And also who's going to be able to get them, the efficacy. And also just that also doesn't mean that we should start being lax about COVID, because I've read some reports that COVID vaccine may not even reduce transmission of the COVID virus. It only prevents severe symptoms from manifesting. So you might still get an infection, but you won't get a severe infection, which to be fair is what the flu vaccine does. But considering how virulent COVID is, it is still a huge, huge risk to, even if you do get the vaccine, to become completely lax about the precautions regarding COVID.
Yeah, there's just so many factors where you can't just, like, a vaccine is not this, like, much as we wish it was, it's not this magic cure-all that just fixes everything. And also another thing to consider is just logistics. Young athletes, probably not going to be top of the priority list for distribution. You might be able to get some government concessions or something because of their priorities in representing their countries and stuff. But in general, not necessarily going to be super high priority. You have dozens of countries with all varying logistics in terms of their access. You know, holding worlds, even with no audience, you still need a ton of volunteers. You need a lot of people to make it work, all the judges, all the... Logistically, if something's going to happen in March, you're probably not going to be able to get everyone in skating who is expected to participate vaccinated beforehand.
In general, I think the ISU has shown that they are unable to, again, have foresight about how to run a competition, or at least create a contingency plan for a competition to be safely held, either virtually or without an audience or with a bubble. Like, again, sports have been going on during the pandemic. I don't know how every single sports federation, especially international sports federation, has been, you know, handling everything. But with enough planning, and if they're that motivated to get to make sure worlds can happen, with enough planning, creating a bubble, allocating lots of funds to get making sure all the athletes are tested and quarantined before they get to the venue, before they get into the country. These are things that I think can happen. I don't think that we should have to sacrifice necessarily if there are enough precautions in place, but I don't think that the ISU is invested enough to make an alternate worlds happen.
Yeah, I think this is sort of the dilemma. Is they either do not have or are not willing to divest the resources to do a proper bubble. Also, the problem with skating and training, you're not going to find countries with a million ice rinks where if you have everyone come in and quarantine, you know, even if, say, you did a situation where they came in and they quarantined for 2 weeks, and then you're like, okay, well, people can train a bit. You're not going to have enough rinks and ice time for that many people to adequately train in probably pretty much, I don't know that any country really has the infrastructure for that. So, you know, say the ISU was invested enough to delay worlds for 2 months, find an alternate location. We should talk about the logistics of even Sweden and the concerns around Sweden being the current host federation / country for worlds, because in general, while Sweden, you know, is not known for doing a poor job hosting events in any way whatsoever, but Sweden itself has taken one of the most blasé herd immunity, sort of infamously, approaches to COVID. And while I'm sure if they hosted it, they would follow some degree of international guidelines and safety, it's not necessarily a country that's been terribly conducive to great care or to anything even they're the anti-bubble basically in Sweden.
Yeah,
so not super promising on that end. You know, even if you hold it without an audience, even if you try to get the majority of people vaccinated and isolate as much as possible, it's still not without considerable risk considering the amount of people who would have to travel to this event, no matter how rigorous your testing is.
And even if they held it without audience, but the sheer number of people that are traveling just from the athletes, that's a lot of people.
And I think, you know, some feds have also raised concerns about this. Like, Canada literally stated that they might not even send the national team if worlds happened. Like, and Canada is one of the biggest countries, like, in terms of skating. Like,
yeah, and I feel like there should be more pushback from the federations as well to signal to the ISU that they're going to be taking the health of their athletes seriously. And it's kind of, frankly, alarming that more feds aren't. Again, it's not like an easy decision, obviously, to just push back on the governing body, but we're in a public health crisis right now. That's not getting better. In fact, it's getting worse. So we've kind of already hit rock bottom a little bit. I just don't see where it gets worse from here, which is like kind of scary to say, but I honestly feel like we've basically hit rock bottom. I'm like honestly surprised that there isn't more outcry.
Yeah, the fact that more feds are not pressuring, granted, not publicly. I'm sure there's plenty going on behind the scenes, but the fact that there is not more public outcry, and you know, skaters obviously are put in a horrifically difficult situation where they can't really speak up.
I feel worse for the skaters. I think that it just sucks being put into limbo constantly. I can't even imagine like the wait for the Grand Prix assignments and whether the Grand Prix was going to be moving forward.
Looking at the internal side of NHK, we've talked a lot about sort of the audience facing precautions. I would probably commend NHK for the fact that in terms of mask usage, protecting the judges with plexiglass, they did monitoring for their athletes, you know, through health check-ins for 14 days prior to the event. We did talk to Tim Coletto, who was the ice dance champion, along with his partner, Misato Komatsubara, about their experiences at the event and preparing for the season as a whole. And here's that interview now.
So we have Tim Coletto here with us for this episode. And Tim, congratulations again. We were just talking about your A, Japanese citizenship, and also B, first NHK win. Were there like Thank connections you. Between the two, or did you feel like it gave you a bit of a boost?
No, absolutely. The timing was very busy, but it ended up being a really fantastic 2 weeks. I got the information on the Thursday before the NHK trophy. So they actually have a national like official newspaper, and every day they have a section where they post the people who were given citizenship that day. So actually just before practice that morning, I decided to go ahead and check it. Typically I check in the afternoon, and there I was.
Amazing.
So, yeah, I'm still kind of digesting it because immediately we went into competition, and then right after competition last week, we had an ice dance camp as well. So it's been kind of a whirlwind couple of weeks.
Yeah, I can imagine. Was that ice dance camp in person or like over Zoom or?
Yeah, it was in person. They planned a space for us that was able to be isolated. And yeah, we worked together with a few different coaches. Yeah.
So all ready for nationals coming up? Is that kind of still the plan at the moment?
Yeah, just about ready. I mean, we have 2 weeks of training left, so there's a lot of little details, but not a lot of big changes going into it. So we're excited to hopefully perform two more solid performances and close off the year well.
Yeah, amazing. Well, fingers crossed for that as well. Yeah, so we were just discussing, I guess, the situation around the GP series. Obviously, it's been a weird, weird season for everyone. Mm-hmm. And I guess even prior to the season starting, there was obviously an adjustment that all the skaters had to make in terms of adjusting their training for remote working, for not being able to actually mm-hmm. physically be in the rink. So I know you and Misato, you know, probably need a little less adjustment than usual, maybe, because you have been training long distance in the past as well, due to sort of your citizenship situation. So can I ask a little bit about how maybe that training worked out in the past and whether that's changed a little bit in the COVID times?
Yeah. So last year we went in the spring and early summer for 3 months to Montreal to choreograph both programs and get it all ready to go. And then we came back here in the summer to do our shows and start our training. But honestly, there wasn't a lot of infrastructure to do online lessons or perhaps a lot of incentive. It seems silly to say now, but nobody really thought like, oh yeah, we could do like live Zoom lessons on the ice. Like it was all, you know, either off ice or checking in or meetings or, you know, we met up with the coaches at Cup of China, etc. But I think part of that was also due to Misato's concussion last year that kind of took us out for quite a few months. And we did go back to Montreal for 2 weeks in the fall of last year, but other than that, we had kind of been on our own. So it's odd to say, but this year has actually been quite a bit easier for us for a number of reasons. First of all, because the coaches and our whole team got used to managing all the different schedules. They're also working with the skaters in China and now also in Australia. And you know, I think we're all kind of, we have our schedule where we figure out what days work for everybody, and we have the ice planned. And we're really lucky to have found ice here in Japan that allows us to work at a time when we can deal with the time difference. But compared to last season, it's actually been quite a bit easier. We also integrated Kathy Reed into our coaching team, which has been a big help to us, and she's been such a great source of information and experience. So it's been, in a strange way, a little bit easier than the year before. And just piggybacking off of what you said, it seems strange to say, but an advantage, I guess, that we kind of already had spent time away from our coaches and knew some of the challenges that come along with that.
Yeah, can you expand a little bit on those challenges?
Yeah, this is our 5th year skating together, so we have a lot of experience together, as well as dealing with injuries and things like that. But shifting out of the role of being an athlete into being a co-pilot and a co-coach with each other is a really slippery slope, and it's dangerous territory because there are times when you need somebody to say something, and the person you trust the most is, you know, standing right next to you holding your hand. But that person also has the ability to hurt your feelings the most, you know, because we're partners, you know, on and off the ice. And there's boundaries that are different than just between a coach and a student. So we kind of had moments where we got in arguments, or we went too far last year, or the injury made it more difficult, or, you know, trying to manage, like, it doesn't feel safe, but we have to try to start skating again. You know, all those kind of things were big challenges in the beginning. And now, like I said, we have more lessons with online time. We do also do lessons in the house with ballet and ballroom dance and Pilates multiple times a week. So in a long way to say, it's almost less that we've learned how to coach each other, and more that we've learned that it's not possible for us to coach each other. And we found ways to fix that, you know, by integrating Kathy and finding more lesson time with the coaches. That has really helped us grow a lot, and it's helped us grow in our love and respect for each other as well, because we recognized how difficult it is to kind of feel like you're training alone. I mean, even though we had coaches here, the ice time is, you know, 1.5 hours a day, or only a public session that could have 50 people or 4 people. You know, so the situation changes all the time, and our coach has like 30 students. So on a mixed session where they're single and ice dance, it's really hard to get, you know, attention for everybody. So it's so easy to slip into that space of, like, from helping each other into teaching each other. And I think the 1st year really taught us that that was not a space that we can operate in a professional way. And I don't think anybody can, but for us, that was a really big learning experience on where are the boundaries between coach and student, and where is the boundary between helping each other and just pointing out faults and making things slow down, you know? So that was a big part of the growth, was just understanding what our roles are on the ice. And you kind of can't completely understand until you make mistakes and you pull back and you know, you realize what kind of system works best for you. And I'm sure maybe there's other couples that can sort of coach each other in a situation like this and would be successful. But for us, we really found the solution was integrating more of our coaching team as much as possible and stepping back and just being students.
And it sounds like maybe because of the pandemic, like the sort of infrastructure for having that coach support and that outside, source of supervision and, people to support you in your training, like people sort of been forced to create that, right?
Totally. So the infrastructure was also there, and it gave us all kinds of ideas that we never had maybe thought of in the past. Like last year, we would have never thought about a lot of these Zoom lessons on the ice, or typically, for example, Kathy might be busier doing choreography or traveling a lot more. And this year she was really present here and had time for us. So it ended up changing a lot of things for the better. Yeah.
Is there a sense that, I guess, like, that you'll carry over some of these new practices, or is it kind of like everyone's just sort of biding their time and waiting for things to go back to normal?
You know, that's an interesting question, because in the beginning, I think after Worlds, we spent 2.5 months off the ice, almost everybody, all the rinks were closed. And then we came back to Japan. And then we, of course, we have 2 weeks of quarantine in the house. So it ended up being like almost 3 months that we didn't skate. And in the meantime, we were doing, like I said, Pilates, ballet, and ballroom dance, and also hip hop dancing, all through quarantine. All the teams, we were doing Zoom lessons every day to stay motivated and have something to do. And when we got back on the ice, we realized what a great help and how many tools we were able to find off ice in things that we consider to be extracurricular, or, you know, just to help the on ice stuff, ended up affecting the on ice skating even when we came back in such a big way. Like, we felt our core strength was better, we felt we were more comfortable skating close together because of the ballroom work that we had done. We felt the shapes of our arms and legs improved a lot just from doing more ballet and having more similar shapes kind of drilled into us, and doing a lot of repetitions. And I think that's something we will take in the future a lot more seriously. The amount of work that we were able to do off ice, even choreography, is so much greater than I had thought previously.
Yeah, amazing. Well, hopefully it sounds like there's some fruitful gains from that time. Amazing. So I guess moving on then a little bit to the competitions that we have seen you guys compete in this season. Obviously, it's been a very different, I guess, feeling to both the field that you're competing in and also, you know, who's been organizing and all the sort of processes behind the scenes for competing. So would you be able to give us some insight into your experiences? I guess the key differences that you've noticed in the way that competitions you've participated in have been organized this year versus a normal year.
So typically we start off our season at the Dreams on Ice show, and we have the option to do a competitive program or an exhibition program. It's just to get our feet wet for the season, and it's usually in July. So that got delayed to September. And they ended up putting it in a very competition-like setting. We had 5-minute warm-up. We had our names called just like competition, minimal spotlights, a kiss and cry. So our federation really set up a situation, even though there was no public, for us to be able to practice competing again. And that was really invaluable to the rest of the work that we've done this season, to just, you know, get back on the horse, as we say, because we hadn't competed since February in Korea, which, even saying that now that we were competing in a space in February is so wild to me, because it was already such a global issue at that point. It's pretty amazing that we were able to safely have confidence thinking about it now. But from there, then we had the Carnival on Ice, and we also decided to perform our competitive program there, our rhythm dance, especially because we felt it needed the mileage. And that one had some socially distanced but limited number of public. So then we got a little taste of skating in front of people again. And then sectionals, of course, was our first real competition, but with no public. So I actually thought when they initially said that there would be no public, that it was going to feel really strange. But there's still a lot of coaches, skaters, some media and organizers. So there's, you know, there's enough people there that it didn't feel like completely alone. Like, I thought maybe it would just be us and our coach and the judging panel. But it ended up, you know, being 40, 50 people or whatever at a time. Of course, everybody masked, social distanced, and no shouting, which made a big difference. And I think it's been a reason why there have been opinions, of course, about whether it's been safe to hold Grand Prix events. But some of the things that made NHK operate smoothly, in my opinion, were we were temperature checked for 14 days prior to the competition, and we had to check in with all our symptoms every day. Also, like, we even have an application for that to make sure that everybody's healthy going in. And everyone was very respectful about wearing a mask in the audience and staying in the socially distanced seats. And there was no shouting or cheering. And those kind of things make a difference, I think. And plexiglass in a Kiss and Cry isn't the most beautiful thing, but it makes a difference. And like I said, our first experience at Dreams on Ice this year, they even had the Kiss and Cry with the plexiglass. So it's sort of like, it was definitely strange the first time, but, you know, we've gotten used to it. And at the end of the day, it still feels like a competition. And you're so busy during the performance that you, whether there's 50 people or 1,000 people, it kind of feels the same. You know, you've got your job to do. And long story short, I felt very safe and very taken care of this season. As we're going into the winter, of course, we're all nervous as cases are going up in pretty much all of the Northern Hemisphere.
Yeah.
In second or third waves. So, you know, that's concerning. And I just hope that as the time goes on with the decision-making process, that things are, you know, that safety is taken into account first.
It sounds like a lot of the sense of safety kind of hinges on the various steps obviously being taken to prevent and precaution against, you know, risks of infection. So would you say that the role of the organizers and the sort of the little checkpoints within each of the competitions are the things that make you safe? Or is it kind of also the overall situation going on in, say, the region or seeing the cases go up? Like, do you think that overall situation's affecting your sense of safety, even if, for example, you've still got the plexiglass and whatnot?
No, absolutely, it's both. And it's a situation of the organizing committee and feeling safe in that sense, but also, as you said, knowing that the area that you're going to and the hotel that you're in and the areas that are quarantined, the quality of how well the bus and the eating areas are separated and cleaned and all these kind of things that go on the organizer side are important. But for sure, I'm concerned about later in the season in different areas of the world, how well things will be able to go, and not just in skating, but in all sports and all kinds of large events, you know, especially as vaccine talks begin. But, you know, the third thing that made me feel safe, like I said, was the public being able to, you know, follow recommendations that I think are wise. And I think we've all learned a lot this year about how important community is in a lot of ways, and how important it is that we all take equal effort to take care of each other. So it really does take people respecting the guidelines and respecting the space. And I was so impressed because I thought maybe in the height of competition that people would start to cheer or whatever, but all of the skaters and all of the public were super respectful of the space, and I was really impressed. And that, honestly, that made me feel really safe. Yeah,
it definitely sounds like it's the attitude, right, that carries over towards. Obviously, you can set guidelines, you can set all these rules and precautions, but if you see people not respecting that, like, that would also affect your sense of safety, right?
For sure. Yeah. So there's the area where the competition is being held, the ability of people to respect the rules in the space, and the organizer. I think it's all of it that contributes to the safety of the athletes and of the public. I mean, we're really all in this together, and of the judges and, you know, everybody involved. You know, whether guidelines are able to completely prevent things is a completely different conversation. But yeah, to answer your question, those three things together have made me feel pretty safe during this competition season so far.
That's great to hear. We obviously know, I guess, with NHK Trophy, the scale of the audience and of the event itself was a lot bigger than, I guess, the regional and sectional competitions that you participated in earlier. So I guess one question is, do you feel a difference in the sense of safety or in the organization when faced with like a larger scale event? And do you think it'll be very much similar for nationals coming up?
Yeah, I do feel, especially as we go into winter as well, that the safety requirements have gotten more strict, which I think is correct. And if I compare sectionals to NHK, which were 1 month apart, things were definitely more tightly run, in my opinion, and everything was very well organized, in my opinion. I think as time goes on, we're all learning how to handle this in more intelligent and more clever ways. And yeah, I think as time has gone on, and perhaps another wave is coming or going, that's the biggest thing, is to be able to pivot and learn from not only the last competition and wherever you are, but around what's going on in the rest of the sports world, and try to make things happen in the safest way possible. And if that's not possible, don't try to make things happen, you know?
Yeah. And I guess along that vein, the other sort of area of focus a lot has been obviously around the accessibility of information and updates on the situation. Mm-hmm. I guess obviously as fans, we're usually the last to know about whether or not an event is going ahead or not. But I guess as a skater, you know, how is the communication behind the scenes? Like, do you know in advance if an event might be cancelled, or are you sort of waiting for the announcement? How does that sort of communication process work?
It's kind of depended a lot this year from competition to competition. Typically, we only know things when they become a press release, which might be surprising to a lot of people, but we don't get a lot of information beforehand. You know, with obvious things like the World Championships last year, for example, for us, it was pretty clear 2 weeks out that it was not likely to happen. But you have to, as an athlete, prepare yourself for the competition or be ready in any case. So even though we knew that the likelihood was pretty small, until we got the news, you know, you have to almost like sort of lie to yourself that you got to be ready, you got to be ready, you got to be ready, which I think has contributed to a lot of fatigue this year. And I really feel for the junior skaters, and I worry for the young kids, because, you know, of course the Junior Grand Prix series was canceled, and then the ability to do like B competitions in junior has been very small. I think maybe less than 10 competitions, and then and then Junior Worlds also was of course canceled. So I'm a little bit off topic, but most of the time we receive the information at a very similar moment to the public. Occasionally we'll know that the ISU is meeting on X date and they may make a decision, but we're sort of all in this together, so to speak.
Yeah, at the mercy of the press releases, by the sounds of it.
Yeah, and for the most part, I have like total sympathy, because these decisions are super difficult to make, and you know, there's so much involved with sponsorships and travel and quarantine and safety, of course, and you know, you see certain sports being run in a bubble and you say, okay, why can't we do that in figure skating? But those kind of things take time, and they take a lot of people being able to be on the same page. And, you know, I really, in a lot of words, I'm not impatient for them to make decisions, because I would like it to be as safe and correct as possible. So, you know, we just keep working. And I think part of it that is easier for the senior athletes is the Olympics are coming in 14 or 15 months, you know. So Worlds, yes, or Worlds, no, there's something coming that we all should be working towards. So, but I do worry about the junior kids, that it must be really tough for the motivation.
Yeah, I guess that's kind of, speaking of motivation, I guess, you know, you've alluded to how important it is to have something to work towards. Do you think that's kind of been the key contributor to the struggles that a lot of skaters have been facing?
Absolutely. And I think I should start by saying I just want to recognize how lucky we've been this season to have, you know, I've performed four times, sometimes with an audience, sometimes without an audience. But that is extremely rare this year, particularly in a situation where, you know, we were able to stay healthy and everything. It's I consider that to be a very lucky situation. And I'm very grateful that I've been able to keep some kind of rhythm, because it is really hard to stay motivated. You know, the summer was extremely difficult because everything was up in the air, and you've got to start doing run throughs and you've got to start preparing. And okay, we're probably going to do the rhythm dance the same as last year, I think, but you know, there's just so much up in the air, and I think having little checkpoints along the way is super important. And I know that a lot of the top coaches and the top schools who haven't been able to compete have, you know, created ways to simulate that as much as possible. But it's very difficult. And there have been waves of motivation where some days are easier than others. And this is all very like first world problems, but at the same time, it is our job. So we're trying to find ways to make it work. And the other thing that was difficult motivation wise is at least for us, we like once or twice a year to have 2 weeks off or 1 week off. And we just didn't have any time off this year because you never know when you're going to be stuck in quarantine again, or when the ice rink is going to close, or you won't have a place. So we just have skated all the time through the whole year. And that, you know, that's been a good learning experience, how that affects the body and when to pull back a little bit, even though we're still skating, and how to create a rhythm. Like all of that is important to the physical as well as the mental side of being motivated has been a challenge, I think. But we've definitely been really lucky that we've had a consistent schedule.
Yeah, definitely seems to be dependent on where you are and the situation as well, which I guess again kind of brings up questions of, you know, if Worlds is going to happen, whether or not everyone obviously won't be on the same sort of playing field or have the same foundations for it.
Right.
Yeah. That sort of brings us then to the last sort of thing on the horizon, obviously after Nationals. But in the current situation, other than sort of working towards Nationals, how are you feeling about the possibility of Worlds? Like, will you be returning to Canada at any point after Nationals, or do you intend in Japan as much as possible?
Yeah, so we've already made plans to return to Canada in January, so we're looking forward to that. It's quite the reunion. It's been 9 months already since we were last there, and we weren't there for very long. We were, you know, we came back from four continents, and we were there until April, and that's it. So we're really looking forward to getting to spend some in person, even though distanced, time with our coaches. I think, you know, we've already selected music for next season as well. Depending on how things are going, we want to get started as soon as possible for next season. But yeah, the plan is to return to Canada and get to work. But you know, there could be news about Worlds this month, and there could be news about Worlds in March just before. So we'll see. My personal feelings is, as I said, like thinking ahead to the Olympic year. And then making sure that the rhythm dance is really tight and ready to go in the case that there is Worlds. Because for us, the rhythm dance is the strategy. We need to make the free dance to qualify Japan for the Olympics at Worlds. In the team event, they cut five couples after the rhythm dance. So it's likely that the free dance will be with, you know, USA, Russia, France, Italy, and us, or China, you know, somewhere in that mix where we may end up being fourth or fifth in the free. So the real work that we can do to help our team out in the team event is also in the rhythm dance strategically. So we're going to be really focusing on keeping that rhythm dance fast and tight and moving together and raising the level of our step sequences. But I think our focus regardless will begin to shift to the Olympic year. Yeah.
Sounds like a solid plan. Hopefully you get to test that out a little bit at Nationals and keep going onwards, whether or not Worlds will happen this season.
Yeah.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate all the insight that you've offered.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you to Tim for taking the time to speak with us for this episode and for giving us his insight on what it was like to compete in the Grand Prix this season. Listening to Tim's feedback was reassuring because he did mention that he felt very well taken care of as a competitor and very, very confident and safe in how they did run it on internally, So that was quite encouraging to hear, actually, from someone who actually competing, because it is the skaters we are concerned about, as well as the volunteers and judges and everyone else involved. But it was encouraging to hear that feedback, given some of the opacity with the Japanese Federation. So, you know, realistically, like, my feeling is if you don't do either something relatively to a constrained bubble or, you know, still considerable isolation, intense precautions, no audience, and vaccine and a delay potentially so that, you know, potentially a vaccine can be distributed, like, worlds should probably realistically not be happening. Federations realistically probably speak up more on the implications of it to persuade the ISU to take, like, actually stand up as a governing body properly. If they do hold it, should Olympic spots even be decided at this world? Like, should they focus more on figuring out some sort of system early for next season? Like, how do you even, if so many countries can't even compete properly or can't send their normal top athletes because of health issues or something to compete for spots at Worlds?
I mean, I have always personally thought that deciding Olympic spots from the prior year's Worlds was a stupid choice. I mean, I can't be mad if they decide to change their Olympic spots assignment system.
You know what? If they cancel World now, they have like 6 months to have coffee breaks and figure out a system for deciding it earlier next season. Regardless of how things play out, we are really honestly anticipating the ISU's deliberations regarding the logistics of holding Worlds, and we hope that they will decide quickly.
Also, cancel World Team Trophy. Let's be real. No one's going to be at World Team Trophy.
Honestly, if Japan Federation wants to have a vague mock competition to give their athletes lots of monetary funding, because it has one of the richest prize money rewards for competitors. So if they want to turn this into a domestic event and give the domestic skaters lots of funding, I'm not going to be opposed to that, because it's been a really tough year for athletic funding. So by all means, have it be like regional. You could do regional teams or something for fun,
or like do it virtual or something. Like, they don't even have to be like team things. They could just like all be like in their rinks or something,
right? This is just a fun competition anyway, so
it's all for entertainment. Yep. It's fine.
Hopefully they will make decisions that truly prioritize the health and future of these athletes, especially given the shortness of skating careers and the sacrifices involved. So fingers crossed things don't implode more. Thank you so much for listening. We hope to see you again for our next episode, whenever it is. Thank you to Lei so much for conducting the interview with Tim Coletto. And thank you to our transcribing and quality control team for working so hard to ensure the quality. And Evie, our wonderful editor-in-chief, for handling the episode edits. And Gab for giving us our fabulous graphics, as always.
If you want to get in touch with us, feel free to contact us via our website, inthelowpodcast.com, or on Twitter. You can find our episodes on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, and Spotify. And if you enjoy the show and want to help support the team, then please consider making a donation to us on our Ko-fi page. And we'd love to give a huge thank you to all the listeners who've contributed to our team thus far.
You can find the links to all our social media pages and our Ko-fi on the website. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please consider leaving a rating and a review if you've enjoyed the show. Also, please take care, and if we don't produce an episode before then, have a wonderful holiday season. Stay safe.
Please stay safe, social distance, masks.
Yes, wear masks. You know, take precautions. Congrats for basically surviving 2020 at this point.
Yes, it's been a hell of a year.
It has, so round of applause.
But we really do want to thank all of our listeners who have stuck around with us in this crazy time. It's been a rough year for all of us, but we are very, very grateful to you. This has been Kat.
And Bex. Bye.
Bye.